Welcome to the SICK Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting SICKs across the global diaspora.
Welcome back, everybody, to the SICK Network Podcast. This is our second season starting after a couple of weeks break, and we're on episode 13. Many of our regular listeners would have heard our first season's 12 episodes covering a range of topics from what's happening in Punjab, politics in the UK, serious campaigns such as the Free Jiggy Now campaign, the Sikh Identity campaign and the census, issues of that impact our Nauja'an and next generation such as grooming, and many other topics that we've covered, injustices to the Sikh community, whether it's the 1984 Sikh genocide or more locally, the Ricky Real case of a Sikh boy that was racially murdered in London and remains unsolved to today. And the Sikh Network podcast is really an opportunity to cover these real issues, dive into the topics that many people either avoid, refrain from discussing, or have kind of ignored and not really had the platform in the community that they deserve. And our goal has always been to bring these guests who have lived and know the detail personally and really discuss and get to the details of this stuff and share it through our ongoing conversations. I'm delighted to be joined by Sikh Network podcast regular Mankamal Singh and Manveer Singh Bogle. And today's special guest is Gurpreet Singh Anand, who is the current Mukh Sevadar president of the Khalsa Jatha British Isles Gurdwara, known as Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara. And today's topic really is about, we're going to talk about the importance of Gurdwara. But let me welcome all our guests today on the podcast. Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa. Waheguru Ji Ka Fateh. As I mentioned, today's topic, we've seen Gurdwaras play a huge role in the community, and that stems from our Gurdwara in Punjab. And the role the UK Gurdwaras have played has been fundamental to life and how Sikhs have evolved in the UK and integrated. And I believe the history of the Khalsa Jatha British Isles dates back to 1908 as a Jatha, and they established the first Gurdwara in the UK in 1911. And that's really what we want to uncover, that a lot of people go to the Gurdwara either for a function, an akhand paath or some kind of wedding or other family event, matha tek, have their langar. And we've seen Gurdwara recently do a huge contribution to society with langar seva, both inside and outside the Gurdwara. But actually, some of these historic Gurdwaras have played a fundamental part in socially, religiously, politically, and economically. And it's important that we understand our Gurdwara as institutes and as pillars for our community and center and hubs for our community, not just somewhere where we go to Matadek at a Gurpurb or an event or a family occasion. So we want to get into the details of this. And Gurpreet, thanks for joining us and taking the time out. Obviously, you're the current Pradhan of the Gurdwara. You've been connected to this Gurdwara Sahib for many, many years. And with the long history, and I know you're a bit of a historian nut as well. So tell us about the Khalsa Jatha British Isles that was established in 1908. Tell us a bit about the history, the founders, and actually how it all came about and that concept of taking a jatha to an actual Gurdwara. Share that history and that story with the viewers.
So to go to the beginning, you would be looking at Sant Atta Singh Mastuane Wale. And he actually, you could say, recruited and sent Sant Teja Singh, who later on became Sant Teja Singh in life, Mastuane Wale, along with others to the UK with the specific instruction of actually spreading Sikhi, starting a Gurdwara in the UK. So they were all there. What you had was you had two types of migration at that point into the UK. You had those who were very much intact in their Sikh identity and those who adopted the Western identity. Dejah Singh was intact in his Sikh identity, and although initially at UCL, where he was he started in London in UCL, he later on learned that Sikhs were being refused entry into Cambridge because of the Dastar, because of their bug, because of their identity. And he decided to go enroll at Cambridge. And here you see your first instance in the UK of Sikhs actually setting up, fighting for their rights, for their identity. So Dejah Singh was again hit with the Cambridge ban that you can't wear a dastar if you want to come to Cambridge. He actually argued it out with them and persuaded them otherwise, and they changed that policy, and Dejah Singh managed to get enrolled in Cambridge. So you could say the Sikhs coming into the UK at that point, it was one to further our education. You also had Sikhs coming in from the armed forces, Sikh royals from the various Maharajas, from their families visiting the UK. And that was your sort of initial migration. You could say temporary migration. People who were coming in those days, they didn't really have intention of staying, but some did end up staying longer.
So this is early 1900s, before the wars, which really led to most of the migration from India. What was, from your knowledge, I guess, what were some of the numbers of Sikhs that we would have seen in the UK? And would they mostly have been academic for study and students, or was there more military aligned officers connected to the British Raj, as was then? What would have been the dynamics of those coming here?
You would have had the military, you would have had people coming to study. Obviously, to be studying in London in those days, you had to be from well-to-do families. You had people from the Maharajas coming. You would have people who were involved in the government, involved in that, in the British Raj. It wasn't all Gauri. They would have different Sikhs who'd be involved too. People from all different backgrounds would be involved, and they would occasionally come visit London.
It's interesting, Gurpreet, that the Mustawane Wale connection in this, because Santhanta Singh is probably credited with a lot of 20th century, sort of early 20th century prachar of Sikhi in Punjab, and we associate him. His prachar in Punjab has been quite sort of influential and again, setting the scene for even SGPC and in the Singh Sabha there at that point in time. But he was very influential. But I didn't realize the international connection as much. And it just shows how the foresight and vision was there, that there is going to be migration, there is going to be a diaspora. So we do need to start thinking along those lines. And you can certainly see that trail of thought, I think, emerging in 1908 when he sends Dejah Singh to start exploring, building a base in the UK at least.
So Santhanta Singh Mustawane Wale was instrumental in getting many Sikhs to take Amrit, to come into the Panth. So that was a time when you saw, you would say, in the 1800s in India, to the early 1900s, you would see a lot of people actually coming into Sikhism. I would say probably even my family around that point, or maybe a little bit earlier, came into Sikhi at that point. So you saw an expansion of the Panth going on. People who were maybe living side by side with Sikhi, but were from a Hindu background, or even people from Muslim backgrounds, people were coming into Sikhi, Amrit Chak Dipe. And that's a interesting correlation to, today, that you see Amrit Pal Singh in India, in Punjab, getting people to once again to connect to their faith, to connect to the Panth, to connect to being a part of something. And that's where you got this concept of, why did they call it Khalsa Jatha? Why didn't they name it something else? Khalsa is our supreme form. Khalsa is when we start to achieve getting into the realm of being like our guru.
So was that an instruction to come and set up a Gurdwara, or was that a need, given that Sikhs were now residing in predominantly in London and the UK, and as all Gursikhs and Sikhs are, we need a Gurdwara. It doesn't feel home, or you have that gap. So how was that, or was it more a specific program that, okay, we're going to go there and establish a Gurdwara Sahib? Because obviously this is the first one. There wasn't any Gurdwara in the UK at this time.
So it was a combination of both of what you've said. One, there was instruction to do it. Two, you know, by being there, by virtue of being there, a need arises. So initially they were trying to gather funds and they were managing to gather funds in India. But then ultimately you had the Maharaja Patiala visit, and they put together a group of people to meet with the Maharaja Patiala. Some of them were from the Sikh regiments who were based at Hampton Court at the time, and the others were students. And they met with the Maharaja, announced it in the Times as you would do in those days. And the Maharaja gave generously towards setting up the first Gurdwara, which was a house in Putney.
Wow. So isn't it, it's quite interesting, actually, you mentioned about the duality of it and about, you know, an order to go out and propagate the faith. Wasn't there the same kind of thing that happened in the United States as well? Like, I understand that, you know, there were lectures that took place in the US immediately after Fateja Singh, after coming to the UK. Is that correct, Spudgy?
After being in the UK, Santeja Singh went to the US. Then he was involved in Stockton Gurdwara, which is the first Gurdwara in the US.
I understand he actually went to Harvard as well.
Yes, he did. He did his studied in law there. You know, that's where he
incredible.
So you got Cambridge and Harvard.
And it's fascinating when you look at the origins of the, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't know much of this until we started looking into this. We talked about Sant Mustan Wale, but then you talk about the royals, but Kahan Singh Nabba, I think most people would have heard of him, a Punjabi scholar, writer, hugely influential with his work. And he's connected to this Gurdwara Sahib. In its origins as well. I mean, the list goes on, and we'll explore some of the Sikh personalities that have been involved with this Gurdwara from the start or through its journey. But from the very start, you can just see these real iconic figures from Punjab having a connection to this Gurdwara and its establishment.
So the initial house in Putney was a rented property. And they decided they needed something bigger and more long-term. In 1913, they acquired the lease of number 79 Sinclair Road in West Kensington, a stone throw away from where the Gurdwara is currently located. Now, living just round the corner from 79 Sinclair Road at number 10 Sinclair Gardens was Max Arthur McAuliffe, who was dear friends with Bhai Kahan Singh Nabba. They had worked together in doing the first proper translation of the Guru Granth Sahib Ji. I mean, better than the one that Trump had done earlier. Then they'd worked together on on his book, The History of the Sikhs. I think he assigned the copyright. So it's a bit of a desi thing to do. You know, if you're going to set something up, set it up near to where you got a friend. So
did you think Max Arthur McAuliffe was involved in that initial finding of the property, for instance, if it was so close to where he lived.
Probably so. I wouldn't doubt it. It's hard to dig up black and white facts, but looking at it, it seems quite obvious.
Do you think the location is quite coincidental that just over the road is Maharaja Dilip Singh's house that was in London as well? If I'm not mistaken, that's 53 Holland Park. So there seems to be quite a lot of kind of Sikh history there, doesn't it?
Yeah, you've got Kensal Green not too far as well. So you would have had, that's where Maharani Jind Kaur was cremation took place. So, and you would have had, I gather then, the other Dilip Singhs as well, the children of Dilip Singh would have been in that locality as well.
So you do have a lot of history with Maharaja Dilip Singh's family. Also, Maharaja Dilip Singh's children used to be involved. I wouldn't say strictly involved, but definitely attended the Gurdwara. There were some dinners where Princess Sophia Dilip Singh, attended a program at the Gurdwara where they had convalescing soldiers come during World War One. Again, there was senior MPs attending at that dinner. I've seen sort of pictures of it, and it was quite interesting. They'd set up all these round tables, and it was all done pretty formally.
So it's interesting. It shows you that the first Gurdwara in the UK, and it is not only a place for spiritual connection, Guru Granth Sahib Ji, Prakash, but also discussing the issues of the day, round the table, debating, discourse, whether that would have been economic, settlement, or political back in Punjab. And so it just because obviously we've had conversations on this podcast before of people's interpretation or view of a role of a Gurdwara, and the meaty peaty concept is very clear. But actually, the first Gurdwara in the UK actually practiced that meaty peaty concept from inception.
Funny because the Jallianwala Bagh connection in terms of impacts with Punjab and actions taken here. I mean, obviously, Gurpreet Bhaji can give us far more intricate history on it. And you're completely right in what you say, Jas. I personally, and I spend a fair amount of time at the Khalsa Jatha as often as I can, and I personally view it as, like all of our Gurdwara, they're effectively Sikh embassies, areas of land which propagate Sikh ethos, miri biri concept. And it seems like that's been taking place at the Khalsa Jatha from the outset, as you mentioned.
So again, going back to that name, Khalsa Jatha, what is a Jatha? A Jatha is a group of people. How do you take, what's your decision making process? A Jatha kathe baithke charcha karenge. They will discuss and debate something to hell, establish a position, and their jathedar will have to go represent that position. Jathedar's role is to go bat it. So they would definitely have been getting involved in politics because if you don't do it, no one else is going to come and do that for you. You know, there's no, you haven't got some guardian angel looking over you who's going to come and do those things for you. So their early letters on the Khalsa Jatha letterhead, and it's quite interesting to see the Khalsa Jatha logo because that logo was there before the current Khanda symbol, which you see is now largely adopted. You see letters where they're writing to the Canadians, where they're writing to all different places, making representations. And that is the role of the Khalsa. Khalsa goes across all fields.
Ajit, just to step it back a bit, what was this notion of Dharamshala and why was it called that for a while?
Well, in those days, you've got to remember, Sikhi is progressing. We will come up with new words, new terms. In those days, a place was generally known, places were known as Dharamshalas, where you would spiritual meets. Gurdwara started getting more used later on, I'd say probably after the 20s and 30s, and you sort of saw the word Gurdwara getting attached more often. I mean, if you look at, you know, the name. So Sri Harmandir Sahib, Bangla Sahib. But it wasn't Gurdwara Bangla Sahib or Gurdwara Sri Harmandir Sahib. It became more later on. I think people felt the need to differentiate, to make sure that someone wasn't confusing us maybe with another faith. And you saw the more of the adoption of the word Gurdwara later on.
So the name Maharaja, what his name? Maharaja Bhupinder Singh Dharamshala stuck with the Sinclair Road site up until you moved to Queensdale. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. It's the most people would call it the Khalsa Jatha British House. So even in those days, although they it was the Maharaja Bhupinder Singh Dharamshala, out of due respect, that he did stump up a lot of money for it to come into effect.
What's the acquisition around that as well, Budgie? Because Queensdale Road used to be a Salvation Army site, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. It was a Salvation Army citadel built by the founder of the Salvation Army, James, in 1846. It was known as a Norland Castle. So the Salvation Army are quite interesting. They would feed the poor downstairs and pray upstairs, and they had a band. You know, maybe you could say their version of Kirtan and their version of Langar. So we're still largely using the building to the same effect. We're praying in the Darbar Hall and doing Langar in the basement.
So I mean, the asset value of that Gurdwara, I know we're going off tangent here and we're talking figures and
London
stuff.
London properties.
It's a London property. I mean, it's a prime spot. And I know there's been problems as well. Yeah.
There have been nefarious activities around selling it.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah,
well, I mean, if someone was to try and sell that with the view of that we want to make some out-of-town gurdwaras, you could do a Gravesend, a Southall, and have money left over for another.
Yeah, because it's the iconic location, isn't it? I read somewhere about that when you did move to the Queensdale site, and it was Norland House, the council were actually after that property. So it wasn't as smooth, wasn't it? It was more or less a kabza, wasn't it? The Singhs had to go there and put a kabza on that and say, we want this property, we're going to take it over.
They said, sada property, you're not going to do a compulsory purchase order on us.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a block of flats the council were thinking of actually housing there, weren't they? Or a large block of block of flats to go up there.
So in a way, you know, this is one of the things in life, nothing is easy. It's a constant battle. If you're going to succeed in anything you do, you got to, you know, continue at it. You know, don't stop. If someone's going to try and take your thing, you stand up for it and you fight for it.
So this address, obviously, the Queensdale, this is the current location, whereas I think most people outside of the locality refer to it as Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara. And its current sort of location. But again, even at that site, obviously the history continues from its early inception, founding, establishment, to then obviously being attended and seva happening via various types of sangat, whether they were, like you said earlier on, Punjabi soldiers, elites from society, students, but also probably other non-Sikhs. But I guess the biggest, most notable time in during the sort of 20s, I guess, early 1920s, was the connection with Shaheed Bhai Udham Singh Ji, who, as Manveer mentioned earlier, after the 1919 Jallianwala Bagh massacre, obviously you have him coming over to England to seek a revenge and avenge that massacre. And tell us a bit about his journey to London and his involvement with the Gurdwara, because we've all seen the photographs where he's making prasad there and doing langar seva. But tell us a bit more about some of the inner sort of information you would have been party to.
So let me tell you about that photograph of Shaheed Udham Singh making prasad there. We found some pictures of the Gurdwara taken by Time Life magazine, and all that photo said was, a Sikh gentleman making puri. You know, there he was doing velna. It should have been obvious to us, but it wasn't. We just thought it was a good photo. And myself, Peter Bans, Tony Paul, Amarpal Sidhu, we put a book together in 2008 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Khalsa Jatha British Isles. And we put that photo in because it just looked good. You know, there was this guy in the 30s making roti, you know, let everyone see that, you know, even the men can come do some velna when needed. So we put it in. It was a great photo. And then about a week after the book got published, we got a call from India. Where did you find this immensely clear photo of Shaheed Udham Singh? Uh-huh. You know, what? Shaheed Udham Singh? We were quickly running to the book, taking a look. Oh my God, it's him. He's even wearing the same jumper.
And if anyone has not seen it, anyone listening in, Google it. Right, Google Udham Singh, Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara, and I'm sure it'll come up. And it is, like you said, such a clear picture, because before that, largely the pictures were either the newspaper prints of where he was arrested or paintings. And largely in Punjab, it's usually paintings that people have in their houses. But this was a photograph right there and there in at Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara.
There's a group photo as well that you published where Udham Singh is standing at the back, actually, quite prominently, sort of standing away from the crowd, as well.
So I'm going to step away from all the films, all the books, and I'm going to tell you one of the things that got me interested into the history of the Gurdwara. I grew up, and as a child, I would, from the real buzzards, hear stories of Shaheed Udham Singh. And this was awe-inspiring, you know, to hear about from people who had met him and people who knew him. But the story they told me was very different to what comes out in the films. In the films, he's shown as some communist revolutionary. And, you know, I guess everyone's going to want to get their claws in someone. In life, you get that. Everyone wants to, culturally adopt something, you know, that Shaheed Udham Singh should represent our cause. You know, so the story I heard about Shaheed Udham Singh was very different. He was a happy-go-lucky character, not always successful in everything he did. You know, he was a guy who really tried, and they loved him to bits. So in all our friend circles, we've always got one friend, you know, whatever he or she tries, you know, it just doesn't work out. They put their best effort in, and you love that friend a little bit more than the others because, you know, they
keep trying, right? Keep trying, coming up with a new one.
They keep trying, and you really give them time. And that was the story of Shaheed Udham Singh, happy-go-lucky character, and the committee there in those days, so they loved him. They saw him as a friend. They called him by this nickname, Baba. So the opportunity came. He saw that Michael O'Dwyer was going to be talking in Caxton Hall. And he thought, I want to get this bugger. Now, this is, again, what I'm going to tell you is not in any film, but it's, you know, one of those anecdotes carried down in the Sangat of the Gurdwara. So Shaheed Udham Singh needed to get a gun, but he didn't have the money. In those days, the Gurdwara was very quiet. There weren't that many Sikhs around. It's not like you go...
The Gorlok them days.
Yeah, it was the Gorlok was there on a Ramallah. It was open Gorlok. No one around. He went there, picked up the money he needed, and left an IOU note saying, "Main paise kaum de seva le leke jaaya, shayad main wapas bhi nahi kar sakunga." I'd heard about that note and spoken to people who'd seen it. I don't know who's got it now. You know, one of the old Gurdwara Pradhans has probably kept it in their collection, or it's always been forgotten about in someone's drawer. But, I've heard about that note from a few different people. And so he took that money, went to buy a gun, went to a pub, bought a gun off an Irish dissident. The bullets were one caliber, the gun was another caliber. You know, so you could see that he was sort of set up to be doomed even from there. You know, that was his sort of luck. He was trying, but it wasn't going to work out.
But he still managed, obviously, he set out to get Michael O'Dwyer in that respect. But I think I assume that there were other, his intentions were more than that on that day at Caxton Hall then.
Definitely, was. I think after Michael O'Dwyer, the gun went to Lord Zetland. He was
Secretary of State. Yeah, at the time.
So, you know, but Shaheed Udham Singh that morning, Matha Teke Das Karke Gaya.
And I think that
Karke Uda Kaam Ban Gaya.
Yeah, but this is the thing with Maharaj Kirpa. It just shows you that not only did he take his guidance from the Gurdwara and Maharaj.
Yes.
Took the Shakti from Ardas, and also knowing he may not return. But Guru Kar this Golak Chon Sevali for the Panthak cause. And actually wrote that himself to say this. And there's been these, and we even fast forward to today, the Gurdwara and the Guru Kar are our center to support the Panth and the Qaum. And those who are at the forefront of doing Panthak Seva rely on the Gurdwara. And whether that's support, hosting events, booking coaches, arranging Sangat, backing causes in Punjab, the Gurdwara has always been that central to not only for the Sangat, but for resources. And again, I'd not heard this or was aware of this actually, but it's just... So, like you said, it's so inspiring that is the core purpose of it.
Jas, I always come back to it. And I guess it's ironic given where the Gurdwara is located, but it just makes you realize that these are our versions of embassies. They are there to support the community, the Qaum, as we always call it. They are our embassies. And I think what that action has shown you is that, you know, whether it's right or wrong, the initial action to take money for this sort of thing, we can all argue that, but there's no doubt that the intention was to avenge, you know, an activity which took place, which was so damaging for our people back home.
And the parallel here is, and the important thing is, most, if not all Punjabis, I'll probably say all Punjabis, revere Shaheed Udham Singh and Shaheed Bhagat Singh and Kartar Singh Sarabha, as freedom fighters from Punjab that effectively moved the dial on the independence movement.
Well, not even just on what we call Indian Punjab, even on Pakistani Punjab.
Yeah.
Even there, so revered.
And given that there's that so much admiration for their heroism and their shahidi, and actually when you learn the actual events of it, of how it transpired and support and how it happened. And then you parallel that to more recent Sikh movements at the 80s, where similar struggles, Sanjan Lal Singh Khalsa Pindarwale, the Sikh armed struggle in the years after, following the Akal Takht, Alarnama for Khalistan at the Sarbat Khalsa, and hundreds of Gurdwara in the diaspora were supporting, rallying that call, supporting in any way they could. But it's just, I think, something for people to think about, that one is absolutely accepted and revered and they're proud of, and one they seem more controversial.
Let me interject. Indira Gandhi was not happy about, the Gandhis were not happy about Shaheed Udham Singh.
Right.
So, you know,
back then, the Congress weren't. Yeah.
It took a while to even get his body returned to India for cremation. It took a lot of work, a lot of effort. Ultimately, if you are a state actor who's looking to do bad by your population, you're not going to like revolutionaries who might pick up a gun and come for you because, you know, you've massacred your own population. And that's what, you know, Michael O'Dwyer was involved in, a massacre of a population he was responsible for. He was a governor general, yes, albeit he might be colonial, whatever the situation is, he was responsible for the safety of that population. And under his watch, thousands got massacred.
It's interesting dynamics, this. Now, I'm going to be a bit controversial on this, Gurpreet, because I know we've spoken offline about this, but that relationship with Michael O'Dwyer is a bit of a strange one as well, because didn't the Jatha also hold Gurpurb events in certain establishments in it, which we'll probably find shocking now. But for instance, Guru Gobind Singh Ji's Gurpurb event was held at Caxton Hall. Michael O'Dwyer was invited. So there were strange dynamics at that time as well. And I think obviously what Udham Singh did afterwards was a wake-up call and probably a reality check to everyone to say, look, it's got to be more clear-cut.
I don't think Michael O'Dwyer was in the UK, so he wouldn't have been invited on when they did their dinners in Caxton Hall and other places. It was a place in Westminster, I can't remember the name, but Caxton Hall was used in 1909. Guru Gobind Singh Ji's Gurpurb was held there. Again, you know, they invited different lords and ladies and different people from all the political spectrum. And one was to create that knowledge around who was Guru Gobind Singh Ji, what did he represent? Because there was a need to make sure that people actually understood who the Sikhs were. You've got all the Sikh regiments, you know, there's a lot of stuff going out there. People were seeing pictures of Sikhs on cigarette cards, and you know that was the only way they were finding out about all these various different Commonwealth soldiers. So there was definitely a need to try and spread the word on what Sikhi is and get people introduced to it. And actually, interestingly, you know, looking into the 30s, that era, you used to have a lot of Gore coming to the Gurdwara.
So yeah, with them, still do. With that era then, and again, because we have this dynamic even today where you have Gurdwara Prabandhaks, which are, let's say, more state obedient or play into the narrative that we should conform and follow and be mellow. And then we have our Panthak Jazba, which is actually, we have to stay true to our Sikhi spirit and our activism. And the Gurdwara is our, as Manveer said, our embassy is our center of organization and spirit. What was it during that time then, Gurpreet? What was the stuff you've picked up and uncovered around the Indian independence movement going on from the 20s, probably when it got really active, obviously post Udham Singh's Shahidi and action, obviously Bhagat Singh, and then leading up to the eventual independence. And the Gurdwara's role, where did it see itself? Or was it split, or did it sort of support it, back it? What the sort of stuff you've uncovered on that?
So the Gurdwara was a place where everyone was coming. There was nowhere else. You would have Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, Christian, atheist, anyone with an Indian connection was coming there. It was, again, that natural hotbed of, hey, we want the British out. This is occupation. We want them out. So anything which would be your major political question of the day would be there. As I said, what is a Jatha? It's a group of Sikhs. It could be just us five here on this podcast. We got an issue, back at charcha karo, find out what you want to do, what do you want to achieve, what's your goal, what's your road to get there, and what steps are you going to take, what do you need to do to achieve that. You know, this is how jathas operated, be it something political or be it a battle or, you know, whatever a jatha is assigned to deal with, they will need to say what is their goal and how they're going to get there. So that we have a methodology within the Panth of dealing with things. And, you know, Gurdwaras are your embassies. They are places where you engage. But don't ever forget who your leader is. Your leader is Vaheguru.
Absolutely.
That's who Budgie, and that's who you represent and who you bat for.
Budgie, that's an excellent point, right? Like that is, you know, that what we must focus on. Was it this notion of the Punjabi elites or ministers who were coming here for education? Were they passing through the doors at this time in and around this independent space? And the reason why I ask, I guess if you have a look at a lot of the ministers in Punjab at that time, they're all supremely educated individuals. You know, they know many different European languages. They spoke English to a high standard. You know, I could imagine that some of them had come here for education, and whether they had then passed through the doors at the Khalsa Jatha.
Well, the earliest one, you got Hardit Singh Malik, who was, at 13, he was at a school in Notting Hill, just down the road. Then, you know, he went on in World War One. He fought against the Red Baron. You know, Hardit Singh Malik was a fighter pilot ace. He's got a long story, and, you know, we could spend hours just talking about Hardit Singh Malik. He eventually went on to be the president of the Gurdwara, and later on in life was a career diplomat in the Indian government, in successive Indian governments. So yes, you definitely saw that. You saw Kushwant Singh. Kushwant Singh actually stayed at the Gurdwara. Indeed, he
met his wife, didn't he, in London as well?
Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was the president's daughter, so or the president's niece. I can't remember offhand. The interesting stories. There was one story that Kushwant Singh mentioned, and you're looking at pre-war times when he was here as a student. You know, so he was quite young, but he was sharing a room with a gyani. Said gyani had a bit of a gambling habit. And one day, obviously, the gyani had done quite well. And when Kushwant Singh entered the room, spread across the gyani's bed were just, it was all notes laid out along the bed. Now, anyone who knows manages a gurdwara, and those of you who do manage gurdwaras listening on here are probably going to be having a laugh about, gyanis with gambling habits and things. The things we end up dealing with and having to sort out, you know, Sangat members will probably wonder one day, why have you got rid of this gyani? He was very nice. He was very good. Well, you didn't know about his drinking habit, did you?
Behind closed doors, isn't it? All of that.
So you end up having to sort out quite a lot, you know. And, looking at Gurdwara management, I know I'm sort of going a bit diverse. You know, you don't put everything on Instagram. Each thing you deal with doesn't become a story on Instagram. Oh, this is crap. This is bad. Exactly. You know, let's put it on Instagram. Let's have 12 posts.
Get a Twitter vote on it.
Get a Twitter vote on it.
You've never been to a Gurdwara, yeah. But I mean, if you look at that time period and building on what Manveer said, you're talking around, obviously, the Akali Dal would have been very active. And we know when we did the manifesto and we wrote about Section 10 and the Sikhs' right to self-determination and the treaties that were signed with Britain and the British offer. And we understand, obviously, and I don't know if Master Tara Singh himself, but certainly a delegation came to London and met with the British government.
Master Tara Singh came.
And the offer of that 10-year support, financial assistance, military assistance for the Sikh homeland to be created was discussed, was documented. So would that Jatha and the Akali Dal leadership at that time, I'm assuming they would have visited the Gurdwara as well and obviously had various conversations at the time?
Gurdwara would have been your base for that. To be honest, I don't have that much detail on that visit. Something I want to look into further. We want to write a second edition of the book, and all these snippets that are coming out that we really want to research further. Definitely, what was the dialogue going on at the time? What was the reasons, a Sikh state didn't come into fruition at that point? I think we got to look at it carefully. I think it's too easy to write off Master Tara Singh, or to, you know, we often get into things where we just stereotype our leaders. We would look at, you know, Gere Pinto Aya, that Jaat Kisi or whatever, and not actually take a proper look at what were the dynamics that they were working with at the time. You know, things are never black and white. They have lots of different shades of gray.
You know, that you mentioned just the word Jaat and caste and stuff, because one thing I find really great about the Khalsa Jatha, first in itself, the name is great, but you've never been hellbent. That Gurdwara has never been stuck on any caste, which you find dynamics in most Gurdwaras. You know, even if you see Singh Sabha, but we know deep down inside, if you strip that apart, it's predominantly Jat community. You've got the Ramgarhia Gurdwaras, you've got the Patra Gurdwaras, but here you've really got a melting pot of everyone. I mean, the Patra community, when they first came into this country, were used Shepherd's Bush as a base. You know, you've got obviously prominent people from well-to-do Zamindar families. You would have had migration from different communities. So I think that's a pretty powerful part of the Khalsa Jatha British Isles Gurdwara.
So I would say definitely when you've got a community that is in small numbers in a foreign land, all of a sudden caste and villages and all of that nonsense becomes irrelevant, because you are all working together as one to survive. And if we can get that message out into our diaspora in the UK now, that look, if you want to survive and thrive, you're going to have to let go of these things because they hold you back.
Yeah. Mm. So I think we've talked about obviously the history, the origins and the role the Gurdwara and the Jatha have played in major Sikh resistance movements, revolutionary movements. And it didn't stop there. I mean, if we look at the 80s, 1984, post the attack on Sri Darbar Sahib by the Indian Army and the attack on Sri Akal Takht Sahib and all the Shahidiyan there. And then you have the reaction in the UK. And what I always said is the awakening of the Sikh Qaum in the diaspora, the sleeping Qaum that was woke by that event. And if I'm not mistaken, and God be, you can sort of know more on this, but, and I know someone who's been involved in the June 1984 Remembrance Rally for the last 10 years or so now, specifically in organizing it, but been going since I was a little kid. I think I actually went to the one in 1985. I know my dad went to the first one. But the first ones organized in 1984 by Dr. Chauhan and the Council of Khalistan and the original Jathebandis at that time, the ISYF, Babar Khalsa. What was the Gurdwara's role in all this? Because that was the primary London Gurdwara. And I know it had a huge role to play. So share a bit of that, because that's more our recent Sikh history on activism as well. And many people may not know this because they probably don't associate Shepherd's Bush with our recent Khalistan struggle and post-1984, but it clearly does.
Many of the major meetings and conferences were held at the Khalsa Jatha British Isles. It was a real melting pot because, let's say, if you were to look at the Khalistan movement in the 80s, it was many different Jathabandiyan who were coming together. And that was the one place that was always respected as this is a place where we can come meet, discuss, and take decisions. Also, not only that, it was respected as a place where you, at this time, you would also have Indian officials coming to that Gurdwara, and definitely conversations did take place. It was treated and respected as a place that, you know, where there would be dialogue. You had Dr. Jagjit Singh Chauhan was a regular there. He used to live nearby. When Khalistan House was opened, an embassy.
It was on Talbot Street, right?
Yeah, number 12 Talbot Road. That was opened by one of our Sangat members, just gave a house and there you go.
Many on this podcast probably won't know that there actually was a Khalistan embassy open in London, and it was open for quite a while. Yes. And a lot of activity of the Council of Khalistan, And all of this stuff that really came about was when we were publishing the Sacrifice and Seeks report, and we did a podcast on that specifically, but probably didn't touch on this aspect of it. But there was a huge amount of documentation and government intel on Dr. Chauhan. Specifically, India were really worried on the activities of Dr. Chauhan, and they even pressurized Britain, the Prime Minister, the Home Secretary directly, to remove him from the country, arrest him, even with sort of and sharing their annoyance that he was on the BBC. And the response always was, we're monitoring him, we're watching him very closely, but he's not breaking the law. And then there was cables around, you've allowed a Khalistan embassy to be opened. And that was a significant move at that time. And it just shows the organization that the Jathebandi and these elders had at that time and the foresight that we needed this whole setup. And I believe they had a government in exile announced as well. But just at that time, at the heat of it, then obviously, because most of the active Gurdwara that we recognize today all came post-1984, whether it's Guru Nanak Gurdwara Smedic, whether it's Gurajadev Gurdwara Derby, Singh Sabha Southall, all of these were really, it was the whole Gurdwara reform movement that led out of the 80s that really established them as Khalistani Gurdwara and stages. But before that, it would have obviously been at the Khalsa Jatha.
The president of the day, Sardar Manjeet Singh Sirli, who's passed away now, he passed away in the 90s. He was very dynamic. It's like, you know, very righteous that if someone's done something wrong to us, we're not going to be quiet about it. No one requires us to be quiet about it. A bit like when you look at Princess Sophia Dalip Singh, that she was standing up for the women's right to vote, saying, you know, if you want to take, I'm not going to pay my taxes if I don't get full value. You know, so Manjeet Singh Sirli and his a lot of his family, who I know, very much righteous in that. There was a political righteousness about them. So if something's been done wrong with the Sikhs, you know, they talk. And I remember Manjeet Singh Sirli, he was banned from going to India. Yet, you know, the how India House used to maintain connections with the Gurdwara if you needed a passport on Christmas Day. He could get one organized. It was this really strange thing that you know, from what you say, the Gurdwara was an embassy and still is an embassy, and that it had the ability to get things done, even if you're not in the best of terms with another embassy.
And I guess that connection, and I think it's something that's well known, that connection remains. And I think many will say the Gurdwara is too close or allows the Indian India House and the consulate to be involved. But I guess it's used to having not only officials and visits, but also the spies, and whether they're British intelligence, whether they're Indian raw officers in and out, picking up all sorts of intel, given that it was such a melting pot and hotspot. But I guess you've been involved, if we can bring it up to more recent times, you've witnessed this yourself, I guess, from both intelligence services when the General Brar attack happened in London. And obviously, I mean, the Gurdwara Sahib probably has been under watch ever since it was established. And depending on what was happening, especially after the Udham Singh incident and then the 1984 era, where all these Gurdwara were under the microscope, of both British and Indian intelligence, infiltration happening, and where we saw committee members being sort of how the dynamics changed, the viewpoints changed, and the infiltrators were brought in. And I guess we're still trying to uncover that to this day. But tell us a bit about the Gurdwara's role in some of the more recent events, specifically with the General Brar case, as he was attacked in London, as he walked through London, and a group of Gursikhs attacked him for his directly for his role in Operation Blue Star as well. And what was the impact on the Gurdwara Sahib off the back of that?
It was a major impact on the Gurdwara Sahib. I remember a few days after the assassination attempt, we got raided by the police, and a number of our lads were just picked up, and we didn't know where they'd gone. That happened on a Wednesday night. Thursday morning, I came to know of it early in the morning. I was leaving home, and I didn't know whether I was going to get picked up. I'd had conversations with Ravi Singh from Khal Said on social media, where I actually said, oh my God, I actually saw General Brar on the Jubilee line, and I failed to recognize him. I was looking at him. He was sitting opposite with his wife, and lagda pe koi jaan pachaan uncle aega, kon aega? Who is he? You know, he looks so familiar. And it was only after the event that I realized who he was. You know, he was dressed in the finest Helly Hansen kit. And I think, you know, he just stood out, because you wouldn't see an uncle and auntie, you know, wearing that sort of outdoorsy type gear going around London. And so I'd actually put a comment on a post by Ravi Singh from Khal Said that, oh yeah, I actually saw him on the Jubilee line. And so I thought, oh my God, what have I got myself into here? I went into work that morning, told my boss, look, I'm going to need some time off. We've got a problem at the Gurdwara and I need to go tackle it. And he was very understanding and said, you know, get down there. We created a war room there because we needed to figure out who had been picked up or who was just, you know, had gone visiting someone. You know, you're trying to figure out who was missing. The police are telling you nothing. So we had, you know, a big board, and we were trying to just jot down and getting people to visit different police stations. Then slowly, as and when we found out where people were, we had engaged with lawyers to, you know, help them and get them out. You know, slowly people were coming back to the Gurdwara who had been picked up. Our Granthi had been picked up, you know, and it was a real bad time in just the stress of it all. I think it was about 4 days I was just up with no sleep, just constantly at it. Myself, Jaspal Anand, Majinder Pal from United Sikhs was over. She was with us, and we had engaged with Gareth Pierce from Bimberg Pierce. Mm. And, you know, dealing with SO15, who I think had really messed up there, you know, in how they conducted themselves in doing such mass arrests.
Do you believe the mass arrests were by instruction, Podgy?
Well, a number of those who were arrested and were, when they were questioned, they told us that they had been asked if they wanted to talk to officials from their Indian embassy. Our view was there were war officers there probably, or, you know, there was some sort of representation there. I guess it was such a big international incident that maybe the British or the Metropolitan Police had to give a sign of, you know, confidence to the Indians. But definitely they were there on the ground and trying to find information out also. I suppose if I was in their shoes, I'd be doing the same, trying to find out as much as possible.
But it's typical, right? Because obviously India had withdrawn his Z security years before anyway, and Brar has that target on his back and will have all his life, and many others have that target on their back all their lives, and I remember that day because I was actually on the radio talking about it, I think the day after
2012, I think it was around about the Olympics,
and it was surprising how many people were absolutely supportive of it. In that, in fact, anything that happened it was coming. And I think the most telling part was his wife's comments, in that she said that they'd regretted it ever since and they were having nightmares. And it just shows you that when you attack Sri Darbar Sahib and Akal Takht Sahib in the manner they did, and the mass murder he ordered, that you're never going to, generations are never going to wipe that sin. And I think to hear her say how much it tormented them, I think was quite a powerful thing. And then it's something that shows you that, you know, anyone who's sort of char ke aaya Guru Ante, that then this has been the outcome. He may have survived the attack in London, but I don't think he actually lived a free life ever and had a free night. And it just shows you the influence that whilst the Indian government withdrew his security, suddenly leapt on the British government to then use an excuse to just target the Sikh community en masse, make huge arrests. And we've seen this now with Jaggi. It is a direct parallel again, in that as soon as something happens, the Indian government then pressurized the UK government to act, whether there were raids, whether there were extradition attempts, or whether it's silencing Gurdwara. This sort of activity, I guess it's, we see it today, but it's always been there, right? It's always happened.
Because I actually refused to hand over the Gurdwara CCTV to the police. You know, Sara CCTV, So, unless they had some sort of order, I refused to give it because, if these guys had come in the Gurdwara, done matate, gone out, they would have interacted with so many different people at the Gurdwara. And, you know, you got the police looking at the CCTV. Okay, he met that guy. He met that guy. He spoke to that member of the
Sangha. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and in the Gurdwara, I don't know whether other Pradhans do it. I'm very much like, if anyone I meet at the Gurdwara, anyone I see who is new there first time, I actually make a point of going them to welcome them, letting them know this is your home in London. Because in a way, that they're coming to your home, they're coming to the embassy. You know, you have to welcome them. So you'll talk to so many different people. Now, let's say if they're watching that on CCTV footage and saying, okay, he's met these 10 people, or that person met those people, let's go pick them all up. Because, you know, that's what they were doing at the time. So I was not confident to give that CCTV over. And it led to, phone calls coming from India and stuff like, look, you need to give that CCTV. And as I said, look, what is that attitude of Khalsa? What? You ain't getting that CCTV. It's not yours. I don't care who phones me.
Defiance in the face of oppression, wherever it may be.
If you have some legal mechanism to come take that, lelo.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
you know, that's our CCTV. We paid for it. You didn't pay for it. It's ours. We don't want to give it. Quite simple as that. And that's probably where I got the maximum pressure being put on me at that time. I wasn't president in the committee or anything. I think I was assistant general secretary was my role, but quite often, whenever the proverbial hits a fan, I always end up dealing with it. And that was one of those moments. So we just, you know, we were very much hard and fast with the police that we don't want to give you that CCTV.
I think it's safe to say, from a community perspective, it's, you know, a sense of gratitude that someone who was as steadfast in, you know, taking that line took it as far as they did. Otherwise it would have been a wholly unsettling experience for the Gurdwara itself, and there would have been a cloud over it from a long period of time. It would have become a point of conjecture for a lot of people, rightly or wrongly. So no, that you know.
Yeah, there's no reason they needed that. We're a Gurdwara. Yes, we have got CCTV. But I've got to respect the privacy of the Sangat coming in there. Mm. You know, it's not something which is going to just get shared lightly. People ask for it. I'm just say no. What do you need it for? oh, my handbag went missing. Well, you need to look after your handbag.
I think these are
CCTV to find your handbag. We'll buy you a new one.
This footprint that that Gurdwara has, Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara as we know it, I think is so unique compared to all the other Gurdwaras, not just because Shepherd's Bush started so long ago and it's got sort of a longer duration of history, but it's just so, I think the things that have happened and you know, the events that are linked to that Gurdwara, I just don't think, you know, any other Gurdwara in the UK can probably sort of claim that. What's it like now? What's 2023 looking like for the Gurdwara? Because presumably when I go there, it's a lot. I mean, from observation, it's the Sangat have moved. You've probably got less people living in that locality. So you've got probably the loyal Sangat members who've got a long history like yourself to the Gurdwara. I know there was always this, there were threats that they were going to close the Gurdwara, move to Ealing and where the Sangat is and all of that. But you've secured and ensured that that won't happen now as a young committee. So what's 2023 looking like for the Gurdwara?
So 2023, we're looking to just continue building. So the Gurdwara is successful. We don't have any financial worries. We're well looked after by our Sangat. There is definitely now more and more Sangat in the area, insofar as a lot of Indian professionals who are moving into London, working for banks and other companies, they are choosing to live in St. John's Wood, Hampstead, and therefore...
good salaries then.
That becomes their local Gurdwara. And in a way, the Gurdwara is probably doing better than ever I've seen in my life. This January has been one of our busiest ever in terms of bookings and things and people wanting to do functions, you know, all the things that people would say why we shouldn't be succeeding as a Gurdwara have just, with Guru's kippa, that to be not real.
That's probably, we're sort of coming to the end of this discussion, I think, and I think that's something that's quite telling, not only with your seva, but following in on the legacy of the Gurdwara and the origins of the Khalsa Jatha, as you referred to a number of times in that concept, is that actually that's how they're the principles on which we should manage our Gurdwaras, because we all, those who are involved are all just caretakers of the Gurdwara, and they have a duty to support and serve the Sangat and ensure maryada of our Guru Sahibs is followed without compromise. And you've sort of continued that in this Gurdwara Sahib, even with its long history, and actually even making it relevant to today, to our struggles today, whether they're political, whether they're local or international campaigns. We've always had the support of Khalsa Jatha in any campaign that the Panth has undertaken. So again, it's a sort of way of working and way of managing Gurdwara. And you probably have one of the most diverse Sangats across the UK. And if it can be done there, then it certainly should have no issues with Gurukar up and down the country. And I think that's the example really that you've set there. And I think that's great for you to sort of come onto this podcast and share the long and rich history of Shepherd's Bush Gurdwara and the Khalsa Jatha British Isles from 1908 all the way up to 2023. And long may that continue. And certainly with stewards like yourself in charge, I can certainly see a positive future. And please continue serving the Qaum and the Panth, because there's much more to do and much more to strategize on and to be involved in. So I want to thank all my guests for joining us today. Thank you all for your contributions, and look forward to joining you on the next one. So, Tifa de Blondia, Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa. Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa.
Welcome to the Sikh Network Podcast,
a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting Sikhs across the global diaspora.